Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
David McCullough is the most widely appreciated and widely read historian in the country, and probably in all the English-speaking world. His great books about Truman, about John Adams, and many others are very, very well known. His new book is a fascinating extension of his interest in Americans. In this case, Americans abroad, in Paris, in fact, but not the Paris of the 1920s, the Paris of the 19th century. The title of the book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. During the second hour tonight, and in celebration, to be sure, of July 4th, we will do a replay of our conversation with David McCullough over his book of a few years ago, 1776. That's his account of how the winning of the Revolution began. Here, then, for the first hour, a conversation with David McCullough about his new book, The Greater Journey, recorded only a few weeks ago. Paris, René du Monde, Paris, vous êtes une blonde, says the old song. Paris, sweetheart of the world, Paris, you are a blonde. But that isn't the way American visitors necessarily perceive Paris, particularly in the 19th century. Or did they? I put that question to a very old friend, David McCullough. Yes, that David McCullough, who's got a new book titled The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. But it's Americans in Paris in the 19th century.
It's Americans in Paris between 1830 and 1900, period of 70 years, about which, in my view, much too little has been written, but because I felt that there was a great story to tell there, I decided to do it. And it's been one of the most interesting experiences of my writing life. I've had a wonderful time with all of my books. I've never regretted any of the subjects or the projects I've undertaken, but I've never had the good time I've had with this one.
How so?
Well, my wife tells me that it's because it's the most autobiographical of all my books, though I do not appear in it. I never use the first person singular. Because I have been interested in painting all my life, I've been interested in music and architecture all my life. I grew up in Pittsburgh when one of our neighborhood heroes was Gene Kelly, who went to the high school. And
The American in Paris.
And the American in Paris film had a very big impact on me. Mm-hmm. Then an older brother came back from Paris when I was still in high school and began telling me all that he'd seen and done and how I had to go there and so forth. And the first time I went was 1961. I was with the government on my way to Morocco in a tour through the Middle East, and my wife and I, Rosalie, landed at late at night in February. It was dark, it was raining, it was awful, and we put our bags down in the hotel and went out for about a two-hour walk through the rain, and we seldom have ever been so exhilarated to think that we were finally at last in Paris.
Where were you? On the left bank, I presume.
We were on the left bank, a little hotel on the left bank, still
just off
Hotel de Saint-Pierre, still there.
L'Hôtel
de Saint-Pierre?
One of my favorite hotels in Paris.
Tiny little room.
Stayed there many times.
Yeah, you know it well.
Just around the corner from the Brasserie Lippe, one of the great...
Yes, it is.
The greatest brasserie in the world.
Yeah. And I can't get enough of it. Now, many people ask me how much time I spent in Paris. I've worked on this book for 4 years, and you must have spent a lot of time in Paris, they say. Well, as a matter of fact, I haven't, because the material from which it's drawn is all here, in letters and diaries of these... It's wonderful cast of characters.
Well, it's quite a collection of Americans.
It is, of all kinds. From painters to medical students to people went for ideas like Charles Sumner, people who changed the world with inventions like Samuel F. B. Morse.
You know, I was trying to remember where I first encountered and had the surprise reaction to John Singer Sargent's Madame X. According to what I learned from your book, it is permanently located in London.
No, it's in the Metropolitan Museum.
It is at the Met.
Yes.
Because that was my memory somehow.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And the other two that are so important in this particular story, El Jaleo, his wonderful big painting of Spanish dancer, and his haunting portrait of the daughters of Edward Boyd. Those are both in Boston. So I was interested in people who brought something home, as it were, figuratively or literally. And St. Gaudens statues are in many of our most important cities, including Chicago.
Do I remember correctly that St. Gaudens, when he wasn't in Paris, when he settled down and did much of his famous sculpture, lived someplace up in New Hampshire?
That's correct. He spent the last years of his life there in Cornish.
Cornish, New Hampshire.
Right near Dartmouth College.
And I used to teach at Dartmouth, and I visited the St. Gaudens estates.
It's a wonderful, I think it's in many ways, it's my favorite national park, and most people don't even know it is a national park. Yeah. You can see everything he ever did in a duplicate, to be sure, but the duplicates are exactly the same. And it's just a beautiful setting, as you know, there on the Connecticut River. And
the other famous resident of Cornish, New Hampshire, for many years, was the reclusive author of
Catcher in the Rye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Salinger.
Yes. I had to cast this book. I couldn't, if he wrote about everybody who went, it would become a catalog. So I had the pleasure of picking those people that I felt, A, went because they were ambitious to excel in their field, not to have a good time or to make a social splash or any of those things. And B, that they were changed by the experience. And then that they brought something home that changed us, that affected American history. Most Americans have very little, I think, or insufficient appreciation of how much of what we are and how we perceive things, the way our country looks, the very names of our cities, and we're affected by the French.
Well, they also gave us. Without them, we would not have had our victory in the Revolution.
No,
a common judgment,
because they helped bankroll the Revolution, along with the Dutch. And as most people do not realize, the army under Rochambeau at the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown was larger than Washington's army. Mm-hmm. And
also
the French fleet showed up at exactly the right moment.
They blocked,
that's why they had them in the bag.
The British,
they couldn't escape.
Yeah.
The country was more than doubled in size by the Louisiana Purchase. States, towns, rivers, streets, colleges, universities all have French names. More of us are buried in France in military cemeteries than any other country but our own.
Sure.
And if you've been to Normandy or the Argonne, you know how moving that is to see firsthand. There are people who don't like Americans, who don't like the French, and don't care.
There are French who don't like the Americans.
And to be sure. But I find that most of the people who have a thing about not liking France or the French are people who have never been there. They never tasted the food, or they've never walked through one of those beautiful gardens in Paris on a spring morning, or been to the Louvre. All of which were the very same things that so moved and so uplifted the people who went there. But you have to keep in mind how behind we were. There was no school of architecture in the United States. So if you wanted to be an architect, and you wanted to be trained as an architect, the best thing you could do, go to Paris. There were no art schools. There were no museums where you could go and look at great paintings. Our medical education and medical practice was woefully behind. Paris was the great medical capital of the world. An American student studying medicine in Paris in the 1830s, really right up through our Civil War, could learn more in 2 years in Paris than 10 years in general practice.
I learned that the whole medical curriculum at Harvard Medical, is pretty well based upon Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who, of course, had most of his medical training in Paris.
Yes, he did, and taught at Harvard for 36
afterwards.
Years.
Yeah.
But I think what's so important to remember is that Oliver Wendell Holmes was also a great poet, essayist, and the founder of a magazine called The Atlantic Monthly, and he saw nothing incongruous or contradictory about devoting his life to medical science and being a poet and being an editor.
There are so many interesting lives and interesting encounters with transformative experience, Americans in Paris. One that interests me considerably, they all interest me a great deal, is Samuel Morse. course. We know him as the inventor of the telegraph and of the Morse code and so on, but he was a very considerable painter himself. We pause right now to do a very American thing, some commercials. When we return, let's examine some of those careers, some of those sojourns in Paris. Directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with David McCullough. I know that you're probably a little bit fatigued for people to run through all of your awards and so on, but after all, you're the only guy I know who got two Pulitzers for literature. That was for Truman and for Adams, is that
right?
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah. And lots, so many other prizes. And you are clearly and obviously the most widely read popular historian, not merely in the country, but I should think in the world.
It could be, but I try not to think about that. I just try to keep it my job.
I would imagine most of your greater journey, bibliographic research in Paris, would have been at the Bibliothèque Nationale.
Yes, indeed. But comparatively,
one of the great libraries of the world.
Comparatively little was done there because the material is all here. The letters and the diaries of the people that I'm writing about are all here. And in fact, I saw the great Morse painting in the Gallery of the Louvre for the first time here in Chicago. It was in storage. It belongs to the Terra Foundation, and it's been on tour. It was at Yale this spring. It's going to be in the National Gallery this summer. But one entire chapter is about the painting of that magnificent
masterpiece. Well, it is a
masterpiece.
Painting. It is a painting of paintings.
It is a painting of paintings, but it's also a painting with a tremendous story.
Describe it.
Well, he decided that he was going to paint those masterpieces in the collection that he thought were the most important for Americans to know about. And, of course, that meant, in effect, the paintings that he liked the best, and mostly all Italian Renaissance paintings, including the Mona Lisa and others. So in a way, he rehung the Salle Carrée, which is the gallery in which it's supposedly taking place. And it was an enormous canvas, 6 by 9 feet. No American had ever attempted an interior of the Louvre before. And since many of those paintings were hanging very high, he had to invent his own scaffold, movable scaffold, so that he could get way up as much as 10 or 12 feet above the floor in order to do the copy. And his friend James Fenimore Cooper, they'd known each other before in New York, the great author, the great novelist, came every afternoon to watch him work and talk to him while he worked. And as we've all known, when you're abroad, somehow you strike up friendships with Americans, or your friendship that may already exist becomes faster, stronger, because you're abroad. And this was one of the great friendships in the American story. But what makes it such a remarkable and dramatic event was that while this was going on, a horrific cholera epidemic broke out in Paris. People were literally dying in the streets. Both Morse and Cooper were terrified that they too were going to die. Every other American they knew, and lots of other people, had gotten out of Paris as fast as possible. Within less than 6 months, 18,000 people died, right in the city. Cooper couldn't go because his wife was too ill to move her. Morse refused to leave because his money was running out, and the Louvre was going to close for the season at the end of August, the summer season. So he stayed on and wrote back to his brothers saying, "I'm not sure when I go to sleep at night if I'll wake up in the morning." Cooper still came every single day through all of that time to be with Morse. And I don't know of a better example of a friend in need than that was. The painting is Morse's masterpiece as an artist.
Some of our listeners may not actually be able to visualize it and haven't yet seen it as reproduced in your book. Describe what we have there.
Well, it's a scene inside one of the galleries of the Louvre, and the Grand Gallery of the Louvre, which was and I believe may still be, the longest single room in the world, is stretching out down away from you like a vista in a landscape.
With the Venus de Milo at the end.
Yes, but you don't see that. Because it's so far away. But what's so interesting about the painting is not just the choice of paintings that he included, but the choice of people that he included in the scene. Now, normally the gallery was filled with people all the time. As he's painted it, they're relatively few, and half of them, more than half of them, are Americans. He's got himself at front and center, and he's leaning over, giving instruction to a young woman who's making a copy of one of the paintings. So in that presentation of himself, he's reminding us that he's not just a painter, he's a teacher. Over in the corner are Cooper, his pal, and Cooper's wife and Cooper's daughter, who is doing a copy. She was an art student. There was lots of talk at the time, and some speculation still, that Morse, who was a widower, was in love with Cooper's daughter, and that's one of the reasons he was anxious to go and have dinner with the Coopers every night after working at the Louvre all day. There's another American student, another American artist, who was one of Morse's friends and his roommate over on the left, and another French woman who's doing a copy, and we don't know her identity. But in the doorway stands Horatio Greenough, the great American sculptor. So he's got three American masters, as it were, a sculptor, a novelist, and himself in this painting. And he's included women, so that's showing us that he believes that women ought to have every equal chance.
And he's got masterwork paintings from the Louvre.
Yes.
How many paintings are in the painting?
36.
36.
And but it's also interesting what he doesn't include. He includes no French bourgeoisie. He includes no French aristocrats, no French soldiers, which were everywhere, and which he greatly disliked, and includes no priests, whom he greatly disliked. So he's leaving out what he doesn't care for. And, of course, in looking at any painting, you have to think about what has been included, but also, because nothing's in a painting by accident, and you have to consider what is he leaving out, because everything is a process, and writing a book or composing symphony. It's not just what you put in, it's what you leave out. And it was while he was there painting this portrait, this painting, this interior, this unprecedented interior, that he also got the idea for the telegraph. So like Holmes, who saw no incongruity that a doctor could be a poet, Morse saw no incongruity that a painter could be an inventor.
But you must now explain what prompted the idea of the telegraph.
He saw the signaling system that the French had of towers with big arms like the paddles on a windmill to send messages. Those are visual signals. Therefore, they don't work at night. Therefore, they don't work in the fog or rain. Why not have a signal system that used electricity? And he came home, developed not just the telegraph as a mechanical invention, but he developed the Morse code, which, of course, was essential. He then went back to Paris to try and nail down a patent in France for his telegraph. And while he was there, he saw the work of Daguerre, who had invented photography, the Parisian, another artist who had invented photography. And with Daguerre's permission, brought back what was called the daguerreotype to the United States.
In the 1850s or thereabouts.
We're in the 1830s.
1830s, that early?
Yes. Yeah. Well, by this time it's the 1840s, but he went initially in the 1830s.
No, but I think of Daguerre. And
yes. So here's one man who brings back what was his masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And when it was sold in the 1980s and bought by the Tarot Foundation, it was the largest single sum of money ever paid for an American painting, over $3 million.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the Tarot Foundation. Mr. Tarot was a very interesting figure. He was a resident of this area, and he established his own museum.
Yes.
First in Evanston, and then right down on Michigan Avenue.
Yes.
And it only lasted for 10 years or less, I guess, and there was legal fuss about it all, and it was closed down. Somebody was suing somebody with regard to the continuation of the museum, but it was a museum of American art, and it's gone.
Yes.
And I've never been too clear as to what's happened to all the
holdings. Most of them are in storage, but he also established a Museum of American Impressionism in France. So
I did not know that.
Yes. But this one painting, this Morse's the Gallery of the Louvre, has been out on tour. It was at the Metropolitan, I think, a year ago. Then it went to Yale. Now it's going to go to the National Gallery. It's one of the most remarkable paintings ever done by an American.
We are overdue for some commercials. When we return, we should talk about some political figures. One very significant American was shaped considerably by his experience in Paris. It's Charles Sumner I have in mind, who was a member of the American Senate later on, had attitudes which had a great deal to do with how the Civil War was prosecuted and what happened in the struggle after the Civil War. Charles Sumner as a young man in Paris, when we return. But first, an update on the evening's news from Elizabeth Brown.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to David McCullough. I wonder, this must be your 10th visit to this radio program.
It could never be enough.
The new book by David McCullough, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. Let's go directly to Charles Sumner, and let's do a full biographical sketch. Who is he? From the beginning.
Sumner was a fellow from Boston, a family of modest means but not impoverished, who went to Harvard and didn't particularly distinguish himself, then went to the Harvard Law School, came out of that and opened a law office, and after about 3 years decided quite on his own that he didn't know enough. So he borrowed $3,000 from his friends, went off to Paris to attend lectures at the Sorbonne. Now, in those days, any foreigner, which, of course, all Americans qualified for, any foreigner could attend lectures at the Sorbonne or the medical school in Paris, the École de Médecine, for nothing. So all you had to do was to get there and be able to pay for your room and board, and you could attend two of the greatest institutions of learning in the world. So Sumner attended lectures at the Sorbonne on everything imaginable, truly. And as they all did, with very few exceptions, they all had to teach themselves French, because at that stage, French or any other modern language, modern European language, wasn't taught in colleges as yet. So he went to one morning lecture, and this is all in his journal, in his own hand, written down, and he was looking around, and he noticed that the black students were treated exactly as everybody else. They dressed the same way, they acted the same way, and they had the same aspirations as he did. And he wrote in his journal, in effect, how could this be? He said, is it possible that the way we treat black people in our country has more to do with what we've been taught and is not part of the natural order of things? It was an epiphany for him. He came home, got into politics, got elected to the United States Senate, and became the most powerful voice for abolition in the national government, almost to the point of costing him his life. Because after one very strident speech, a Southerner, member of Congress, attacked him from behind.
On the floor of the Senate.
On the floor of the Senate, attacked him from behind with a heavy gutta percha walking stick with the intent of killing him. And very nearly did. Hit him 30 times. Broke the stick over his head. And Sumner never really recovered from that, either physically or psychologically. Because of the news of this savage attack, that set loose John Brown and his crowd out in Kansas, and they committed the Pottawatomie Massacre, an inexcusable slaughter of innocent people. So these things accelerated, and one fed the other, and it changed history dramatically. It was the very fire that set forth the Civil War, and all through the Civil War, despite his physical and psychological troubles, he remained one of the most powerful voices for the Union cause.
He's
for
a leader
Lincoln
of what they call
in the Senate.
He's the leader of what the group they call the Radical Republicans, isn't he?
Yes, then indeed. And he was a very great man. His statue stands in the public garden in Boston. All it says is Sumner. And I doubt there's one Bostonian in 1,000 has any idea who he was. And yet, when he died in 1874, the line of mourners, the whole city was shut down. The line of mourners from the State House, where he'd been lying in state, out to Mount Auburn Cemetery, distance of 5 miles, was lined the whole way on both sides. We forget too fast. This is a man whose memory deserves sustaining.
And then a very interesting political figure of sorts, though his professional life of special relevance is lived in Paris, is Elihu Washburne.
Elihu Washburne, who was a very important figure right here in Illinois and in the city of Chicago.
Well, he was a friend of Lincoln's.
He was originally a friend of Lincoln's. He was a congressman from Galena, Illinois.
Yeah.
And his next-door neighbor was Ulysses S. Grant. And he's the one that pushed Lincoln continuously to put give Grant higher command, give him higher. And finally, mm-hmm. of course, Lincoln put him in full command. Washburne became our minister to Paris just on the eve of the horrendous Franco-Prussian War, and found himself all of a sudden in a city upon which the Germans were rapidly advancing. They very soon put the city, they had it surrounded and put the city under siege. All the other diplomats mm-hmm. for all the other powers had escaped, gotten out of the city, but he refused to leave because he felt it was his duty to stay as long as there were some Americans there. There were only about 150 still remained. It had been probably 7,000 before that, and they'd all gotten out. So he was there through the entire siege, which lasted 5 months. Then he stayed on through the even more horrible commune, where this great city of light, the great epicenter of culture and good living and joie de vivre, turned into a hellhole where the one Frenchman was killing another. They were slaughtering each other with horrific atrocities. And through all of that, again, Washburne wouldn't leave. And through all of it, he kept a diary every single day, writing down exactly what he was seeing and exactly what was happening as near as he could tell. And that diary has been largely unknown, virtually unknown, until about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And
you found it up in...
Well, we found
in Maine.
We found a letterpress copy in the Library of Congress, and it wasn't clear that it was a diary. So the Library of Congress, as they are the first to acknowledge, really didn't know it was there. But if it was a letterpress copy, where was the original? And it turned out the original was up in Livermore, Maine, where Washburne originally came from.
And
when he left Paris, fine, and he stayed a long time, served for more than 8 years. He was one of the finest diplomats we've ever had. And when he was appointed, Milt, it was just a one big hue and cry. Here's a man who has no diplomatic experience, mm-hmm. who is totally inappropriate for so important a post, and there'd never been anybody who did it better. And when he retired, he came back and lived in Chicago.
Doing what?
Being retired. He
just
really
fully retired.
Yes.
Yeah. But the cache of material up in Maine, it had been there for years and years, with
still is.
No one paying any attention.
That's
to it.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
The one more person.
At a college library? Do I remember correctly?
No, it's in a family library. It's it's amazing. I've been doing this kind of work now for more than 40 years, and I've never had the thrill of coming across anything quite like the Washburne collection.
So there's probably a lot of material there that he's publishing, but is not yet published.
Oh yes, indeed. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Another man that I loved writing about was a fellow named George Healy.
Yes.
He was an Irish kid off the streets of Boston. And if you don't mind, I'd like you to just read what he wrote about going to Paris.
I'm very pleased
because
to have you do
I
that.
Think I put it in a nutshell. He said, we should remember, in those far-off days, there were no art schools in America, no drawing classes, no collections of fine plaster casts, and very few picture exhibitions. He wanted to be a painter. I knew no one in France. I was utterly ignorant of the language. I didn't know what I should do when once there. But I was not yet 1 in 20, not yet 21, and I had a great stock of courage, and, this part I love, and of inexperience, which is sometimes a big help, and a strong desire to be my very best. That boy who left Boston, hardly a dollar in his pocket, to go to Paris, very quickly developed into one of the foremost portrait painters of the 19th century, American or European, whose work was sought after on both sides of the Atlantic. He came back to settle in Chicago, and very soon after he came back, he was sent down to paint the newly elected president of the United States in Springfield, Illinois, mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln. And he painted a masterpiece, and it's one of the very few pictures in as portraits or photographs of Lincoln without his beard. That painting is now in the Corcoran Gallery in Washington. Over the mantelpiece in the state dining room at the White House hangs a Healy portrait of Lincoln. It's been there for years, since before Truman's time, I think. And there's six other portraits by Healy in the White House collection. There's 17 portraits by Healy in the National Portrait Gallery. And he is, to me, a great American story. This fellow with all this talent, but also the drive, the determination to succeed, who rose from nothing to immense prominence. And I have to point out, too, that when it came time for him to retire, and he came, after he came back to Chicago, his whole house, all his studio, all his letters, account books, everything were destroyed in the Chicago fire of 1871. So he felt he had to relocate. The family all got together. They all decided to go back to Paris. So he went back to Paris for a number of years, again painting considerably, and people of great importance like Bismarck and Ferdinand de Lesseps and others, and General Grant when he came to Paris. But when it was time for him to retire, he again came back to Chicago. And there are many of his paintings right here in Chicago now.
We are about to pause for the usual reasons. You're looking at Americans in Paris not the way we usually think of them. We usually think of the Hemingway and Fitzgerald and
yes, indeed.
Gertrude Stein in the 1920s,
yes.
Of Hemingway's Movable Feast,
yes.
And so on. This is a very different time.
Yes, and these are very different people.
These are very different Americans, I was about to say.
For one thing, they're not disenchanted with America. They haven't, and they don't feel sorry for themselves.
Yeah.
They're not over there crying into their wine glass. They're there because they want to work hard and learn and bring something back and help their country. And they said so again and again. This isn't something that I'm imposing on their stories. This is in their own words.
A very interesting special chapter in the book is the one about John Singer Sargent painting the famous Madame Gautreau. Isn't that
her
name?
Right.
Otherwise known as Madame X.
Yes.
Let's talk about that when we return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to David McCullough, I was setting you up to talk about Sargent and Madame Gautreau. That is a captivating painting, which stuns everyone who encounters it.
Well, it's a startling painting, and in its day it was considered quite risque,
yeah.
Virtually obscene. And the curious thing about that is...
Much more obscene than a nude.
Oh, there were nudes all around,
yeah.
Hanging everywhere in the museums of Paris, but it was something very suggestive, too erotic, it was thought, for a woman of social pretensions and social position.
And social position.
Madame Gautreau, which most people at the time and today still don't realize, was an American. She was not a French woman. She was from New Orleans, and she'd married a man from New Orleans, and they had lots of money, and they had lots of social ambitions. And so they moved to Paris, and she rose very rapidly. And keep in mind, of course, she was quite young still. She was in her 20s, and she heard about Sargent. And Sargent was in his 20s. Sargent was a boy wonder. Sargent was a genius. And when he arrived in Paris to study under Carolus Duran, the great portrait painter of the time, and people saw what he could already do, they were just flabbergasted. And three of the most important paintings of his whole career, which are all I write about in the book, El Jaleo, which is the great Spanish painting of Spanish dancers, and the Boit Daughters, the daughters of Edward Boit, very mysterious painting, which, like the other one, hangs in Boston, and Madame X, which hangs in the Metropolitan in New York. All were done when Sargent was still in his 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a remarkable man because he was not born in this country. Mm-hmm. He was born in Europe. His parents were expatriates, self-imposed exiles. And but he never considered himself anything but an American. And years later, when he had become supreme in the world, the English, and he lived in London, and the English decided they wanted to make make him a knight. He said, no, I can't accept that because I'm an American, which I thought was wonderful. He was a great piano player. He was charming. He was handsome, tall. He came here more and more as he grew older. He painted landscapes all over the country, the Rocky Mountains, Florida. And I think, without any question, he's one of the greatest of all American artists, one of the greatest artists of the 19th century. And he had a finesse. He had a natural ability with the brush that sort of takes your breath away. There's never a false stroke. There's never... he's like a dancer who does everything exactly right every time.
While these Americans were doing Paris and getting reshaped and transmuted by the Parisian experience, in those 70 years or so, towards the end of that period, there's a particular young physician from Vienna who comes to Paris to get some additional postgraduate training in psychiatry. Or rather, in neurology.
Yes.
And that's Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
Who's at the Salpêtrière, which is a great public hospital in Paris, and studying with Janet and Charcot, two leading neurology,
yes,
quasi-psychiatry figures of that time. And it's in the 1870s or thereabouts.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but wonder, as I was reading this book, whether any of your people crossed paths with the young Sigmund Freud.
Not that I ever saw.
Yeah.
But when you think who was there, Holmes, who was there in the 1830s, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr.,
yeah,
went back to Paris when he was in his late 70s. It was a nostalgic, as he called it, his down memory lane. The only person he wanted to meet while he was there, and he could have met everybody, anybody, was Pasteur. And because he said, I just want to shake the hand,
sure,
of the man who's done what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to see history as more than politicians and soldiers. History is about people like Pasteur. It's about people like Freud and John Singer Sargent and Augustus St. Gaudens, and people with ideas, people who became great teachers. About 80% of the people I'm writing about in this book all come back to be teachers, at least part-time. I personally think there's nobody more important in our society than our teachers. They are doing the work that really matters. They are doing the work that will count above all in the long run.
Henry James shows up in your book. He's visiting from London, as he often did. Are there any other expatriates who stay in Paris? Significant.
Who stay, who
Americans.
Don't come home.
Yeah, well, they may come back to visit, but who essentially live out their lives in Paris.
Yes, Mary Cassatt.
The Impressionist painter.
And she was the first American, the only American, to be taken in by the Impressionists. You're one of us.
Yeah.
And she decided she would just stay there. These two others are other American women who stayed were Edith Wharton and...
Josephine
Baker.
Baker.
Yeah, they're all buried in France.
Yeah.
They all of them never described themselves as anything but Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wanted to be perceived by the French. Edith Wharton spoke perfect French. She was adored being there.
She had a rather tempestuous love life, which Henry James viewed from rather close on. They were friends, but viewed with some ambivalence,
yes,
to say the least.
Henry Adams also came to Paris and wrote there. He professed not to like Paris, but he managed to get there at least once every year. And he wrote most of his Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres, the great study of medieval church architecture, Gothic architecture there.
During the latter portion, the last few decades of the period that you cover, Paris was being physically transformed. That is, the Paris that we know is essentially the creation of Baron Haussmann's.
That's exactly right. Americans lived through that.
They ripped up the whole town.
Yes, it was urban renewal and the grandest scale ever up until then, or maybe ever. And the Paris we know today, the grand boulevards,
exactly,
with the trees and the expanded parks like the Bois de Boulogne, that's all the Haussmann renovation. And by and large, I know this was not what one was supposed to say for a while. He did a very good job. Yes, he did destroy much of historical importance that should not have been destroyed, but he saved much of historical importance, and thank goodness it was so. And then there were convulsions, political convulsions, in the Franco-Prussian War. So this was not all a movable feast time. This was a time of infinite change. And, of course, the 19th century was a time of change, with the advent of the telegraph, the advent of electricity, the advent of photography, the advent of so many developments in medicine that changed everything.
And a persisting struggle in France, which for all I know may even persist to this very day, between those who are of royalist intention and deeply lodged in or related to the church, and those who represent reformist forces and secularist forces, that erupts in France, as you know, in the last decade, or the last two decades, around the L'Affaire Dreyfus.
All the time. And they saw that. Now, most of these were young people who were so tied up, so preoccupied with what they were struggling to learn, that they had very little time to be conscious of
all the political
struggle
around them.
Though they were. And some, like Oliver Wendell Holmes, cared deeply about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Putnam, another brave, determined medical student, cared immensely about it. And they were Victor Hugo fans. And William Wells Brown, the first African-American novelist, was there and very much involved in spirit.
We are just about out of time. Since we're taping this, we have to fit it into the hour that is allotted for it. But it's wonderful to see you still doing so. Such magnificent and such ambitious work. Your last book, 1776, was comparatively slender. This is one of the major tomes, once again.
Yes, I think in many ways I've put more into this than anything I've ever done. And I love the journey of learning that goes with writing a book. I've never undertaken a subject about which I felt I was an expert. If I were an expert, I wouldn't want to write about it, because when I start off on one of these projects, I think how much you're going to learn.
Yeah,
and that's the case.
You've said in the past that what gets you writing a book is that there's a book that needs to exist that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet.
Yeah,
so you're going to write.
So I can read it.
Yeah,
I read it so I can read it.
Wonderful. When we return, in celebration, to be sure, of July 4th, we will do a replay of our conversation with David McCullough over his book of a few years ago, 1776. That's his account of how the winning of the revolution began. But first, to Christopher Michael in the WGN newsroom.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And now for the second portion of the program, a replay of our discussion with David McCullough a few years ago, right after he published his book, 1776. That is a great account of the waging of the Revolutionary War and how Washington and his army lost battle after battle, but still managed to survive. The book got a great deal of attention when it was published, and deservedly, I think it will remain a basic part of the historical treatment of the Revolutionary War. And so, here then, David McCullough once again, as we talk about how the Revolutionary War was almost lost, but ultimately how Washington and a number of people around him, including some significant Frenchmen, pulled victory from the jaws of defeat. Tonight, on this date of July 4th, it is a great pleasure to have with us David McCullough. We are going to be talking about his newest book, 1776. This comes after the Pulitzer Prize-winning John Adams and the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Truman and various other significant major works. You are, you will allow me to estimate, our leading popular historian.
Well, that's very generous of you, Milt. I'm very pleased that my work has had the response and the reaction it has. And I've been at it now a long time, and I'm still enjoying it. and still have more things I want to do.
And you still do it wonderfully well. The narrative is vivid. The human understanding is moving. The character portraits are many of them riveting, including, of course, in this book, 1776. Many interesting characters emerge, but first and foremost is a man who was first and foremost.
The General Washington, who was all of 43 when he took command of the Continental Army. He had never commanded an army in battle before in his life. He was chosen by the Congress, Continental Congress, to lead the forces gathered around Boston, keeping the British bottled up in Boston. Though they were all in the New England Army, he, of course, was a Virginian. His wish was that they understand that he wasn't up to the job, and he made that very plain to them. And I think he also realized that no one was up to the job. And he also appeared before the Congress in a resplendent uniform, which nobody else did,
exactly,
saying that I'm available.
Was he really that humble about let this cup pass me by, or was he also agitating for the job?
I think he was realistic in saying that nobody's up to this job. I'm not up to it. But I think he also knew that he was more up to it than anybody else, and he was ambitious to serve, ambitious to excel in the service of the country. His strengths were not like those of the others that we call the founders. He wasn't an intellectual like Adams or Jefferson. He wasn't a stirring speaker like Patrick Henry. He wasn't a brilliant general like, let's say, Napoleon. He was a leader. And he had the gift, call it what you will, that men would follow him, and they'd follow him through hell.
But that charismatic quality seems to have been crucial. What you make very clear in this wonderful book is, and this is something of a surprise, one knew it was a bit of a ragtag army, one knew that it was a hard winter at Valley Forge and so on, but what you make clear is that it really was, in some degree, what one of the British generals called it, a rabble in arms.
Yes, absolutely. We shouldn't picture soldiers in uniform as we are accustomed to thinking of armies. They were dressed in everything, all kinds of clothes. Mostly they looked like farmers in from the field, and they had no training. They were a pickup army, and they, being New Englanders, were very accustomed to deciding things for themselves, and they felt that they could elect their own officers and vote on whether they wanted to do this or that.
And some of their officers,
Washington,
some of their officers, indeed some of their generals, were mere boys, weren't they? Just beyond boyhood.
Yes. And there were literally boys. There were young. The youngest I found was Israel Trask, who was 10 years old. There were many who were 15, 14, 16 years old. Some were old men for the time, in their 50s. And General Greene, Nathaniel Greene, who in many ways is one of the most interesting men I've ever written about, one of the most interesting men in our history, was all of 33 when he was made a general, and the only thing he knew about the military was what he'd read in books. He'd never set foot on a battlefield.
And General Knox was about 25 or 26.
25. Big, fat, garrulous Boston bookseller, very popular fellow, very bright. Mm-hmm. Again, like Green, knew nothing more than what he'd read in books. But that was an age when it was widely understood that reading books was a pretty good way to learn how to do things.
You begin the narrative on the date, though this is the title of the book, is, of course, 1776. You begin on October 26, 1775, a crucial day.
One of the most crucial speeches ever given in Parliament or anywhere was a speech delivered before the Parliament by King George III, in which he declared that the American colonies were in rebellion, that the leaders of this rebellion were traitors to the crown, and that a sufficient force to suppress this and the rebellion was on its way across the waters. Until then, it had been thought on both sides of the water that this was an unfortunate family squabble. Washington wrote to his wife, Martha, that he'd be home by Christmas when he took command in July. Jefferson, in late August of 1775, wrote to a kinsman saying he would be delighted if we could patch all this up and get back to the good old good relationship with the mother country. And those men who, Americans who fought at Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill, none of them were fighting for independence. They were fighting for their rights as freeborn Englishmen. Very important point. And it wasn't until that speech delivered by the king appeared here, crossed the 3,000 miles of the North Atlantic, to arrive in Boston on the first day of January 1776, that people here suddenly realized this wasn't going to be short unpleasantness. This was going to be a real war. And a few people started to say that maybe we should be fighting for independence. Yeah. And I'd love to read, if I may, a letter that was written by Nathaniel Greene 3 days later. Now, this is a 33-year-old American who's had no education, formal education, beyond about the fifth grade.
What's his assignment at the time?
Well, he's the general, and he's a general, and he's the head of a Rhode Island unit.
Yeah.
And he is a very, very good soldier right away. And Washington spots him as one of the best he has, along with Henry Knox. And Greene knows a congressman in Philadelphia named Samuel Ward. Now, this, to my knowledge, is the first time that anybody has said in a letter, the earliest anyone has said in a letter, we must have a declaration of independence, using those words, and saying it on paper. Now, why that's important is that if that letter were found, if that letter were to get into the hands of loyalists or of the British, he is committing himself on paper to being a traitor. He could be hanged for that. So nobody, they may have been talking about it, but they weren't writing it down. Even when they wrote it down as the Declaration of Independence, the names of those who signed it was kept secret for almost 6 months or more.
But we have John Hancock supposedly saying, yes, it's apocryphal, writing his name so large so that the king can read
it. Yes, but they weren't telling anybody that they'd signed it around where they were. Greene writes to Samuel Ward, member of Congress, we have consulted our wishes rather than our reason in this indulgence of an idea of accommodation. In other words, forget this whole idea we're going to accommodate. Heaven hath decreed that tottering empire Britain to irretrievable ruin, and thanks to God, Providence hath so determined. America must raise an empire of permanent duration, supported upon the pillars of truth, freedom, and religion, encouraged by the smiles of justice, and defended by our own patriotic sons. Permit me, then, to recommend from the sincerity of my heart, ready at all times to bleed in my country's cause, a declaration of independence, and call upon the world and the great God who governs it to witness the necessity, propriety, and rectitude thereof. Now, he's not just saying, I'm for a declaration of independence. He's saying, I am ready at all times to bleed in my country's cause. And he will. And in a way, that's the point of my book, to talk about not just this is 1776, the year of the Declaration of Independence, and the signers of the Declaration of Independence in the drama of what transpired at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, but the large drama of what's transpiring for those who are going out and fight the fight to make the Declaration of Independence something more than just words on paper.
We return directly to David McCullough after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We return to David McCullough. The Siege of Boston comes on what date?
Siege of Boston really begins just before the Battle of Bunker Hill, and it lasts all the way through to March 17th of 1776. And the Americans were brilliant in how they drove the British out of Boston. The Americans had this ragtag army. They had no discipline. They had no gunpowder.
It was a great feat pulled off by the aforementioned Henry Knox.
Henry Knox came to George Washington, and this is an interesting point because his idea gets right to the top immediately and suggests that they might go to Ticonderoga in upstate New York and hauled the guns, the cannon from Ticonderoga down the Hudson Valley, over the Berkshire Mountains, all the way to Boston, nearly 300 miles. It's almost a mythic idea. And Washington likes the idea and says, fine, you're in charge. This 25-year-old kid who'd never done anything of the kind, Washington authorized him to spend $1,000, and he told him he could take his brother along with him, who was 19. And they did it. And they did it by making the problem, and the problem was they were going to do it in the dead of winter, to making the problem the solution to the problem. They built giant sledges, and they hauled the cannon over the snow on sleds through the wilderness. So there were no Massachusetts Turnpike or anything there to haul it down. And then when they got them to Boston, in a very short time, they realized they had the capacity to force the British to leave. They put them on top of Dorchester Heights, which was the sort of the companion hill across the way from Bunker Hill, much higher than Bunker Hill. And they did this with massive manpower, massive use of oxen and labor by guys digging and pulling and hauling. And they did it all in one night. A phenomenal feat. And without the British ever knowing what was up.
Once the British spot it, they run away, don't they?
Well, they woke up the next morning here with these cannon looking right down their throats. And General William Howe, seeing the guns up there, said, those fellows have done more in one night than my whole army could do in 3 months. So that these ragtag characters who couldn't march in step or carry the musket the right way could do that. They could work. But it also gave them a false sense of their who they were, and they got a little too filled up with themselves and cocky. And the British were driven away, shamed, and some of them, like John Hancock and George Washington, said, you better watch out now because they're mad and they're going to come back in force. And they do.
And they come back in force to New York.
Come back to New York, come sail into New York with a fleet of 400 ships, the largest armada ever sent out from anywhere to defeat a distant foe in all of history until
then. And they
then.
Go first to Staten Island, where they kind of group themselves and build themselves some barges to cross what is known as the Narrows to land in Brooklyn. What fascinated me so, I knew there had been a Battle of Brooklyn, but I didn't know that detail. I discovered that it happened under my nose, except a number of hundred years before I lived there. We lived just off Gravesend Bay. I marked a passage, I wonder if you would read it, about their crossing over from Staten Island and their landing on Gravesend Bay.
Before dawn the following day, Thursday, August 22nd, the sky was clear and cloudless, as if nothing unusual had happened. There had been a vicious storm the night before. And with a fresh morning breeze and a roll of drums, the long-awaited British invasion of Long Island got underway. The frigates Phoenix, with Lord Howe aboard, Rose and Greyhound, and two bomb ketches, the Carcass and the Thunder, vessels equipped for shore bombardment, swung loose from their moorings and stood down the Narrows to take their positions to cover the landing. Then at approximately 5 o'clock, with day beginning to break, an advance corps, 4,000 of the King's elite troops, led by Generals Clinton and Cornwallis, pushed off. The men packed aboard scores of flatboats, these built during the time on Staten Island, with British sailors at the oars. Slowly but steadily, in glorious early sunshine, the invasion force proceeded across 3 miles of water until at precisely 8 o'clock, at the flash of a signal gun from the Phoenix, all 4,000 troops went ashore on the long, flat, empty beach at Gravesend Bay. Everything had been carefully prepared, every move of the Army and Navy carefully coordinated. The landing was as smooth as if it had been rehearsed, and there was no opposition. The comparative few of Colonel Edward Hand's Pennsylvania riflemen posted near the shore had already withdrawn, driving off or killing cattle as they went, and burning wheat fields and farm buildings. The dense columns of smoke rising in the air could be seen in New York 8 miles away. As more troops followed, and a naval spectacle of more than 90 vessels filled the Narrows, wave after wave of soldiers came on, their red coats and polished bayonets gleaming in the bright sunshine. One battalion of blue-coated Hessian grenadiers was ferried over standing in ranks, muskets in hand, in the order of battle. By noon, a fully equipped army of 15,000 men and 40 pieces of artillery had landed and rapidly, smoothly assembled in perfect formation on the adjacent plain. And still more would follow, including the women who were with the army.
And they marched forward to the little Dutch town of Flatbush.
Indeed they did. Yep.
Which, of course, in my childhood in Brooklyn, was a major area of Brooklyn, and was indeed also the location of the college I went to, namely Brooklyn College.
Well, I try to tell my friends in Brooklyn and people when I'm there visiting or giving a talk, you're walking on historic ground. You're walking on hallowed ground, if you will, every bit as much as someone touring the Battle of Gettysburg. But you have to use more imagination.
The great composer of that time, the first really great American composer, William Billings, has an anthem in which the words go, Howe and Burgoyne with Clinton too, with Prescott and Cornwallis joined, together plot our overthrow in one infernal league combined.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I've never heard that.
Those names are all the great English generals.
That's
Howe
right.
And Burgoyne and Clinton, too,
yep.
With Prescott and Cornwallis joined.
Yes. And they were fine generals. The idea that these were aristocratic pinheads who didn't know much and were frivolous and miscast is quite wrong, just as it's quite wrong to believe, as many understand, that Mad King George lost the colonies. George III was not mentally ill. His mental illness didn't come for 20 more years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an intelligent man, interesting man, an accomplished musician, a very gifted artist, and he thought he was doing the right thing. And the country was behind him. That's another point that needs to be understood. The English people were for him, and as was the Parliament. He had the votes.
And many Americans were for him as well. We return directly to David McCullough, drawing from his wonderful book, 1776.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
We return to David McCullough. You give a very vivid account of the Battle of Brooklyn, and as a native Brooklynite, obviously it caught my interest a good deal, though it would have caught my interest anyway. I discovered from your treatment of it that it was a terrible defeat for the Continental Army, and that we did a Dunkirk of our own to anticipate what happened
exactly
to the British forces 200 years later.
Yes. Washington had never been in charge of a big army in a battle, and he didn't handle it very well. He was outflanked, he was outfought. He was outsmarted.
You say as well there were some 40,000 troops involved,
yes,
in this.
Yes,
over major battle.
Over 6 miles. It's a big, yeah, big battle. It was the biggest battle ever fought on North American continent until then. And we lost. Everything the British did that went right, everything we did, or almost everything, went wrong. Washington stood on the hill on his horse and said, how many good men must I lose this day? I mean, brave men must I lose this day? And what was extremely worrisome and extremely unfortunate was that he had put himself in a position where he was very nearly trapped, because they pushed him back up to Brooklyn Heights, and the only way for him to get out of there was to retreat across the east, back across the East River.
And the Brooklyn Bridge had not yet been built.
No, but it's exactly where the Brooklyn Bridge stands.
Exactly.
They made their retreat. And all the British had to do was to bring their warships up into the East River, but they couldn't do it because the wind was in the wrong direction. And I honestly think that if wind had been the other direction the night of August 29th, 1776, you and I would be sitting here sipping tea and talking about the Queen's latest whatever.
Contingency in history is so fascinating.
I tell you, it's a miracle we won. But what happened was that the northeast wind, which kept the British from bringing it... all would have taken one or two of their warships to come up right up there across from where the Brooklyn Bridge is.
Mm-hmm.
Washington would have been in the bag. His army would have been trapped. He would have been trapped. And they went down to the river to try to escape, and the river was so rough because of the same wind that they couldn't make a crossing. They'd assembled a little armada of small boats on the other side of the river. Then all of a sudden, as if the partings of the Red Sea, the wind died, and they were able to start across. And they went back and forth all night long, just as you say, like Dunkirk, taking these men off the shore of the Brooklyn side.
What was the total size of the force?
9,000 men. 9,000 men, all their equipment and all their cannon and horses and everything.
How many had they lost in the Battle of Brooklyn?
They lost over 300 killed and 1,000 taken prisoner, mm-hmm. and three generals taken prisoner. It was terrible. It was a terrible defeat. And it could have been a very bad slaughter when morning was coming, the night of the escape, because all the men weren't off yet. There were about 3,000, maybe, of them still waiting to be taken across. And, of course, with daylight, the British would see what was happening, and they would pounce on them, and it could have been an annihilation. But then a providential fog comes in, very dense fog, which covers the whole rest of the retreat. So all 9,000 of them get off without the loss of a single man. And there was no fog on the New York side. It was all on the Brooklyn side. So many people, quite understandably, saw it as the hand of God entering into the mm-hmm. fortunes of the United States of America. But it wouldn't have happened just by chance. What really also made it happen were those sailors that from Marblehead, Massachusetts, commanded by a man named John Glover. You know, the East River, as you know from growing up in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. the East River isn't a river at all. It's a tidal strait. It's yep. very treacherous currents. People who have sailed up the East River tell me it's tricky business. And they took these people across at night, no running lights, boats loaded down so the water was only inches below the gunwales. All the circumstances that were so favorable would have come to naught if those people hadn't played their role to yeah. perfection.
Now, once after Providence has taken a hand and they're over on, temporarily safe on the other side, on the island of Manhattan, what then does Washington do with his ragtag army?
He suffers several defeats. He suffers a terrible defeat at Kipps Bay when the British cross the East River and land at about 34th Street in mm-hmm. New York today. And it's a rout. Then he retreats back up toward Westchester County. There's a Battle of White Plains, which is sort of a draw. He then decides, through the advice of Nathaniel Greene, that they should hold on to Fort Washington, which was up on the highest ground of Manhattan Island, just about where the George Washington Bridge crosses the Hudson. Fort Washington was supposed to keep the British from bringing their warships up the Hudson. But since the British had already demonstrated twice that they could bring their ships up the Hudson any time they wanted, and the guns of Fort Washington didn't matter much, that fort no longer served any real purpose. Washington should have ordered the evacuation of that fort and gotten everybody out of there and across the Hudson while he could. Instead, he delayed the decision, leaving it for Greene to decide until he, Washington, got on the spot. And then when he got on the spot, across the river on the Hudson side, on the New Jersey side of the Hudson with Greene, he left the decision sort of hang. Didn't make a decision. Now, at the time, several people were thinking that this man's not himself. He's too indecisive for George Washington. I think he was suffering from sleep deprivation. The British attacked Fort Washington, captured the whole thing. 3,000 troops, of our troops, captured all their equipment, all their armaments. It was a disaster. In some ways, it was even worse disaster than the loss at Brooklyn. And that's when the times that try men's souls began, that Thomas Paine wrote about in The American Crisis. The retreat across New Jersey, when there was really no hope left.
They're now down to about 5,000 or 6,000 men.
Less. 3,000 men at one point. That's all
that is the Continental Army.
That's what he has. Yeah. There are remnants everywhere. And there are militia in all the states, but the states don't want to send their militia because they think we better keep them here in case those British come and attack us. But that's really the war. And the Continental Army is what matters. And it takes both sides about the full year of 1776 to catch on to that you don't try and hold New York. You don't try to hold Boston or invade New York or drive on to secure New Jersey. What you need to do is, if you're the American Army, is to keep the Army alive and full of fight. If the British Army, you encircle that American Army and crush them, and that will end the war. And Henry Clinton, who was not the commander-in-chief of the British Army, saw that, whereas General Howe, who was a very able fellow, very courageous soldier, didn't see it that way. I think if Clinton had been in command, that the outcome might have been quite different. But there's so many variables. The war could have gone in either way again and again.
Through that whole year of 1776, the Americans are retreating and being beaten. They finally find refuge for a while in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And then comes the magical Christmas night.
Yes.
It's not Christmas Eve, but Christmas night.
Christmas night.
In the famous crossing of the Delaware.
Yes.
What have you learned about that?
Well, that it was much worse than we know. The crossing the river was very hard and very heroic, mm-hmm. No question. But it was the march after the crossing. They had to march through the night, 9 miles through the night.
To get to where the Hessians were at.
To get to Trenton. And they came down on the eastern side of the river, and it was a howling storm. Snow, sleet, rain, bitterly cold. And they have no winter clothing. They're in rags. Some have no shoes. And they're marching through the snow. And the old legendary stories of bloody footprints in the snow is true.
You know, what comes to mind is that attribution to some French general, you may remember who he is, I don't, who says, "My left flank is destroyed, my right flank has collapsed, I advance."
Yes,
and that's
exactly
what Washington was doing.
Well, that's right. Milt, the war was over and we had lost. And when Howe chose to pull all of his army back to New York, he was doing the reasonable thing. First of all, you didn't keep a army in the field in the 18th century in winter, not because you were softies or had to have your nice warm bed. It was because it was very, very difficult to supply an army in the field during the winter time, and almost impossible to keep them warm. So he pulled back quite reasonably, also understanding that the American army was defeated. And I think there's no way to know. The Howe papers, by the way, were all destroyed in the fire. So like the loss of the Washington papers, there are gaps here where we don't know. I think he must have felt, look, these people are finished. Let's not be brutal about this. Let's not grind them into the dust and make generations of enemies. We want them back into the empire. We want them to come back in.
Was the destruction of the capture of the Hessians at Trenton and the destruction of their military situation, was that of great strategic importance, or was it essentially of symbolic significance?
It's symbolic importance. As Washington knew that it would have great symbolic importance. His hope was that it would have the symbolic importance of getting his men to re-enlist. But he also knew that it would have an effect on Congress, it would have an effect on the country. But nobody anticipated the effect on the country. The effect on the country was phenomenal. You know, finally, we'd won something. We'd beaten them. Now, there are a couple of misconceptions about the attack on Trenton. And one of them is that the Hessians were all drunk or hungover from celebrating Christmas the night before. Not true. Our troops came storming out of a, tacking out of a blizzard.
They were caught still sleeping, weren't they, in the main?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And it was a vicious house-to-house fighting, and it was all over in less than half an hour. No American was killed. The toughest part of the whole night was the march, the 9 mile march down, during which two men on the march froze to death. That's how bad it was. That's how pathetically clothed they were. It's something we should all know when we're celebrating the 4th of July and thinking about the Declaration of Independence. These are the people that made our way of life possible.
Now, what kept them going under all of that duress? And for that matter, I raised the question earlier, but I haven't yet asked you to address it. What about the Loyalists? A good one-third of the American population supposedly was still loyal to the Crown, was it not?
What kept them going? I think about that so much. For one thing, they won't desert George Washington, these who are still with him. Keep in mind that thousands had given up and gone home. These are the exception that are still with him.
Yeah. What are the Loyalist third doing? Are they merely voicing their opposition, or are they joining the Brits?
In New Jersey, they're flocking in by the thousands to sign the loyalty oath, which has been offered. All will be forgiven if you come in and sign this oath. Many of them are fighting for the British. More and more of them will fight for the British when the war moves south. Lots of them are just sitting, sort of doing nothing, and over 1,000 of them left Boston when the British fleet sailed away. Mm-hmm. They packed mm-hmm. aboard those troop ships, desperately trying to get out before the Patriots came in, because they knew their lives were in jeopardy.
Many of them out of Boston head north to Canada and establish families that are still there.
That's right, in Halifax. But those people didn't know where they were headed. They were leaving all their possessions, all their way of life, their homes. And I found, in trying to tell their side of the story, I found it to be a very sympathetic situation. They thought they were the true patriots.
Of course, you end, you essentially bring this work to an end with the Trenton battle. But the war goes on for, some 4 or 5 more years?
More than that. Doesn't end until 1783. It's the longest war in our history, except for Vietnam, eight and a half years.
It's interesting, if you fast forward all the way to the end, the final coup d'etat to the British is administered by the fact that the French fleet is out there in the waters beyond Yorktown.
Does exactly the same thing that would have happened at Brooklyn.
Exactly. That was my thought when we were talking about that. Yeah.
So they're caught in the same kind of trap that they had almost pulled off when they had Washington nearly trapped on Staten Island.
We return directly to David McCullough after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It is a great pleasure to have with us David McCullough, talking about his book, 1776. If you were to do another volume, finishing off the Revolutionary War, what would the main points be in terms of how
the American victory at Saratoga, which comes the next year, is one of the great turning points, because that's what brings the French into the war. And the French don't come into the war because they love democracy. After all, the King of France was much more of a monarch than was the King of England. They come into the war because it's a good way for them to get at the English.
And wouldn't you agree, though, that the waging of this war and the winning of this war by the revolutionaries ultimately has serious influence upon the fate of France?
Absolutely. And the French ultimately had a lot of influence on the outcome of our war.
To be sure.
It could be argued that we would not have won the war had it not been for the French. I just think it would have been a lot longer.
It can also be argued that they would not have had their revolution but for the American
example.
That's
right. And the French army at Yorktown under Rochambeau was larger than the army under Washington. Mm-hmm. Another point that many people don't realize. It is a real war. We tend to see those 18th century people like characters in a costume pageant, because we have no photographs of them, and we don't see the bodies stacked up. And
men get their heads blown off.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And the carnage was proportionately terrible. 25,000 Americans lost their lives. That doesn't sound like much to us, given the horrors we've known in the 20th and 21st centuries, but 25,000 Americans dead was 1% of the population, 2,500,000 people in the country. If we were fighting that revolution today, 1% would be 3 million people.
Yeah.
That'd be a pretty bad war. Where in the world, one asked, did all this talent, this extraordinary ability come from, out of a population that small, to produce a Jefferson, an Adams, a Franklin, a Hamilton, a Washington? It's remarkable.
Well, men perhaps rise to the challenges of the times. The men are potentially always there, are they not?
Well, that's what Abigail said. She said great adversity calls forth great ability.
But the thought that I love to play the game of counterfactual analysis when examining history and war, to make that particularly easy to do. Suppose, counterfactual scenario, the very young George Washington had in fact been killed in the French and Indian War, where he took a hand a few decades before, so that there were no George Washington. Is it conceivable that the revolution could have been won and waged and won?
I don't think so. And I think if Washington had been captured at Kips Bay, if he'd been shot at Kips Bay, which he came very close to being, if he'd been captured at Brooklyn, I think that would have been it. The war would have been over. It would have sputtered on maybe in some parts of the country, but no, it wouldn't have. Couldn't have happened. On the other hand, you could argue what would have happened if we had lost the war. I'm not very good at playing at what if, but a reviewer of my book in the Wall Street Journal opposed the possibility that, and he reviewed by a Brit, that had we lost the war and remained part of the British Empire, like Canada, that World War I and World War II might never have happened because the Germans would never have gone to war with a British Empire that included the industrial power, wealth, and population of the United States of America. Interesting.
Yeah, when you play this counterfactual game, in that direction lies madness, because all sorts of alternative tracks in history or in time open up for you. But it is a great, great pleasure to read this book, and it's a great pleasure to see that you're still fully dedicated to plying your very special craft.
Thank you.
You've become, as you must know by now, a national resource.
Well, thank you, Milt. I just do what I love to do.
That's why, one of the reasons why you do it so well.
Thank you. I love to write. I love the research. I love. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm happier than when I'm in a great library with original documents and books and.
Well, where, in fact, do you think you'll go with this next?
Where? What will be my next book?
Yeah. Are you staying with
that
period?
I have no idea yet. I have several ideas. Mm-hmm. What it will be, I don't know. I feel a little like Joseph Hodgkins, one of my favorite characters in the book, who was a Massachusetts shoemaker, cobbler, who wrote wonderful letters home to his beloved Sarah. And at one point he said, if I come out of this alive, I think I might like to rest a spell. That's sort of the way I feel. If I get through this book tour, Milt, I would think maybe I'd like to rest a spell.
Well, I think you're entitled to a few months of that. David McCullough's new book, from which we've been drawing, is directly titled 1776, Simon & Schuster, the Publishers. A last word, what's that wonderful painting that we have on the cover?
That is a painting by John Trumbull. John Trumbull, who served as an aide to George Washington. It's the painting of the surrender of the Hessians at Trenton. And it's one of the big collection of Trumbull paintings at Yale University, and it's just been recently cleaned. Mm-hmm. So it looks very different from what it has been looking like for a long, long time. It used to be sort of a tea color, and now all the vibrant original colors are back there again, and it's the first time it's been reproduced since it's been cleaned.
We also have a number of wonderful portraits by Trumbull, which are included in
section
of the book.
The paintings reproduced in the book are as well, as true as you would see in a fine art book, and I'm just delighted they're included. I'm very interested in paintings. And this is how we can see those people, so that you can see Nathaniel Greene and Israel Putnam, for example. And many of the paintings are also by Charles Wilson Peale, who served in the war. So these are people who were right there. They were all painted after the fact. There are no on-the-spot sketches. There was no artist correspondent like Winslow Homer covering the Civil War, nor were there any regular correspondents, newspaper correspondents, covering the Revolution. They didn't do that then. So most all of what we know comes from original letters, diaries, and memoirs.
David, thank you so much for joining us on a busy day in Chicago.
Well, I've enjoyed it tremendously, and I always like to be on your show.
Thank you.
This has been our special program celebrating July 4th, and I will be back tomorrow live as we talk with Richard Lindbergh, an old friend, who's the author of the recently published book Heartland Serial Killers, and joining him, the great John Drummond, who knows everything about the history of crime in and around Chicago and in all the country and probably in all the world. A great team, Lindbergh and Drummond, as we talk about some of the most notorious murders in the history of the American Midwest. And so, closing down for the evening with best wishes to all and a cordial good night to all.